from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Nutritionists have long advocated a diet low in fat, especially saturated fat. But investigative reporter Nina Teicholz is skeptical of that advice, saying it's based on faulty data. In her new book, Teicholz writes that America's obsession with diets low in fat and high in carbohydrates has actually made us fatter and less healthy. She joins us in studio to talk about her book, The Big Fat Surprise: Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. That's next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Eat meat, even fatty meat. Eat cheese and eggs, and drink whole milk because they're part of a healthy diet. That's the advice that comes out of The Big Fat Surprise: Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet, written by Bay Area native Nina Teicholz. In her book, Teicholz looks at the link between saturated fat and heart disease and finds the science condemning fats is riddled with problems. She argues that the celebrated Mediterranean diet may not be the healthiest, and she suggests that our efforts to avoid saturated fats could be leading the food industry to replace trans fats with something worse. Teicholz's book comes as some researchers and nutritionists are questioning the long-held belief that saturated fat is bad for us. We're joined now by journalist and author Nina Teicholz, who is also a former NPR reporter and has written for The New Yorker, The Economist, and The New York Times. Nina Teicholz, welcome to Forum.
Well, thank you for having me.
So you make some provocative statements in your book, including that almost nothing we commonly believe about fats appears to be accurate. Give us some examples.
Well, it is a kind of extraordinary revelation, and it began with my research into trans fats, which at the time really nobody knew anything about. That was work that I was doing in the early 2000s, and that really led me to look at all of our dietary recommendations about fat. And although in recent years we've come to believe that fat in general may not be so bad for you, that it's better to eat, you know, there are good fats and we should be eating maybe more fats than we were used to in the height of the non-fat 1980s. But I think the contribution of my book is the revelation that saturated fats, which have always been the dietary culprit of the last 50 years, that saturated fats in meat, butter, cheese, dairy, eggs do not cause heart disease.
But don't saturated fats raise our levels of bad cholesterol?
So the story of saturated fats really goes back to the 1950s when the nation was in a panic about the rising tide of heart disease, which had come from almost out of nowhere in the early 1900s to be the number one cause of death. In the 1950s, President Eisenhower himself had a heart attack in 1955 and was out of the Oval Office. And there was a kind of public health panic about what was causing heart disease. There was one researcher whom I describe in the book. His name is Ansel Keys. He was from the University of Minnesota, and he proposed that it was saturated fat that clogged the arteries by raising your total cholesterol and therefore, according to his hypothesis, caused heart disease, heart attacks. And he was this very charismatic, outsized personality who was able to get that idea implanted into the American Heart Association. Our very first anti-saturated fat guidelines were published in 1961 by the American Heart Association. And that sort of launched this whole theory. But in 1961, there was really no solid evidence. The evidence was very weak from the very beginning, and it really didn't get much more solid than over the decades that followed.
But you even say in your book, though, that saturated fats do raise LDL cholesterol, the, quote, bad cholesterol.
Right. Okay. So when Ansel Keys condemned saturated fats, our understanding of heart disease was very primitive. We could only measure total cholesterol. Then over the years, scientists could start measuring LDL and HDL cholesterol. And it's true, saturated fats do raise LDL. They're also the only fat that raises the good cholesterol, HDL. And in the last 15 years, there has been a tremendous evolution of our understanding of biomarkers for heart disease, now it turns out that LDL cholesterol itself is, turns out in many clinical trials, not to be related to, not to be predictive of heart attacks, and that actually LDL can be divided down into subfractions, and the kind of LDL subfraction that best predicts heart attacks is not does not rise with saturated fat. In fact, saturated fat seems to have a good impact on those LDL subfractions. So the story is that our understanding of biomarkers has just evolved tremendously over the last 50 years, and saturated fat was condemned on the basis of kind of antiquated biomarkers that we now know are not so predictive.
But this persisted for years. So how is it decades? So how is it possible that doctors, researchers, academics, nutritionists, the USDA, that we have all been getting it wrong for so long? You mentioned Ansel Keys. How could this one man do that?
Right. So it obviously wasn't just one man. And there were also many critics along the way, people who criticized the weak state of science, the fact that there was a lot of science that only showed associations and not actually causation. But what really happened was that the idea became institutionalized, adopted by institutions before it was ready. And then it became a kind of dogma. So it was adopted not only by the American Heart Association, but also the National Institute of Health, which worked very closely with the American Heart Association. And then the U.S. Senate got on board and adopted this idea that meat and fat were bad for health, that they caused heart disease, but not only heart disease, but also cancer. And then the entire federal government got behind this idea. So you have the wheels of the whole federal government elevating this particular hypothesis, which it became institutionalized before it was ready.
So the hypothesis being that saturated fats lead to cholesterol, which leads to heart attacks, and that we should all adopt a low-fat regime without saturated fats.
That's exactly right.
And you also write in your book that the food industry played a big role in all this, too.
That is true. The food industry, and people always ask me, well, where was the meat and dairy lobbies? Why, you know, why weren't they more powerful enough? And of course, there were food industry lobbies on all sides of this issue. But basically, the big food manufacturing companies won. So, and they understood from the very earliest in the 1940s, they had already organized themselves and understood that it was important to influence science at its very source, to influence, to provide research grants to universities and steer the course of science at its very source where the opinions were being formed. And the hand of the food industry can be seen throughout this story. I mean, one of the most, I think, telling anecdotes was that the American Heart Association, which has been so influential in this story, they were kind of a sleepy little professional cardiologist society until 1948, when Procter & Gamble, the maker of Crisco oil, designated the American Heart Association as the became the designee of a radio show, and overnight millions of dollars flowed into the American Heart Association's coffers, transforming it into the national powerhouse that we know it to be today. And at the same time, the American Heart Association came out saying that we should eat vegetable oils rather than saturated fats. So that's just one example that I think you can that flows throughout this history.
Right. So their interest was, if people are shying away from saturated fats, let's get them to replace it with vegetable fats instead. You know, people were, though, commonly cooking with butter and lard and eating meat and dairy when the epidemic of heart disease hit. So what may have been other factors that contributed to heart disease?
Right. It's important to note that before 1900, the only fats that American housewives cooked with were butter and lard. Also that in 1800, Americans ate 3 to 4 times more red meat than we do today. So, and the heart disease epidemic really did not begin until the 1920s or so. So it's hard to blame the heart disease epidemic on saturated fats. What was ramping up, I think there are many things were changing in the beginning, in the early 1900s in America. I mean, we went from having 0% vegetable oils in our diet. Now we're talking about peanut, corn, safflower, sunflower oil. We went from eating almost zero of those to they're now 7 to 8% of all of the calories that we eat. daily. And so there was a tremendous increase in the amount of vegetable oils that we started eating in the early part of the 20th century. I mean, Crisco was the very first plant-based fat that was introduced in 1911, then margarine. And we were also increasing the amount of grains and sugar that we ate. So those were all factors that were changing.
And so, you know, when what we learned from using Crisco and other things is that they contain trans fats. And so then you write about how we may be now replacing trans fats with something worse. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yes, this is quite an unintended consequences story, which is that trans fats are a byproduct that is created when you harden vegetable oils. So to use vegetable oils as Crisco or margarine, they have to be hardened. That process is called hydrogenation, and that produces trans fats as a consequence. Trans fats have been in our food supply since Crisco in 1911. They were only discovered to have certain problems associated with them in the 1970s. And recently, the FDA has decided to ban them from the food supply. But now we are returning to using just regular non-hardened liquid vegetable oils. The reason that they had been hardened in the first place is that those oils are very unstable. So especially when they're heated, they produce literally hundreds of oxidation products. They degrade into these oxidation products. And those have been shown to be related to have tremendous inflammatory effects and be related to Alzheimer's and to cause gastric damage. The research on those began in the 1940s and has really picked up the pace in the last decade or so to show the problems with them. And if we return to these liquid oils, as we are now doing to get rid of trans fats, particularly in restaurant fryers, those oils are being heated at high temperatures. And the problem of those toxic oxidation products is one that the FDA has really not reckoned with.
And you're saying that those could cause potential health problems in terms of the oxidation process.
Yes, there's a lot. There's animal experiments, and there's quite a number of suggestive studies now out there that are not in journals typically read by the nutrition community. They're in molecular biological journals and free radical research and in places that are sort of outside the realm of what nutrition researchers normally read. Yes.
And we're talking with Nina Teicholz. She is the journalist and author of a book discussing the merits of a high-fat diet. Her book is called The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet, and she'll also be at the Commonwealth Club tomorrow. How did you come to write this book? I understand you were a vegetarian before this.
Right. I mean, most of my adult life, I didn't eat any red meat. I ate some chicken and fish, and I was basically trying to follow the dietary guidelines and eat a low-fat diet. And it wasn't until I got this little side job reviewing restaurants in New York City, and we didn't have a budget to pay for meals, so I just had to accept whatever the chef decided to send out to me. And that was not chicken and stir-fried vegetables, which I had been used to eating, but more often red meat, creamy sauces, cream cheeses, all these things that I had rarely eaten. And I found them to be rich and delicious and textured, earthy foods. I also found that I lost effortlessly the 10 stubborn pounds I had been fighting. And my doctor said my cholesterol levels were fine. And so that was a mystery. I mean, as an investigative journalist, as anybody, you want to get to the bottom of that.
Right. And so that's what led you on this 9-year hunt, apparently.
Well, also, I originally started writing a book about trans fats, and it was when I started researching and diving into the literature about fat, dietary fat, the history of our dietary recommendations, that I realized it was a much bigger story. And then that book kind of morphed into this book. And it was an incredibly long journey, mainly because I wanted to go back and read all the original studies, those original studies dating from the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, because as studies are summarized and passed along in the review literature, the details get lost. And also those review literatures, the bias that has been introduced over the years in favor of this idea that saturated fats cause heart disease, that bias minimizes any of the original problems in those studies. So I had to go back and really look at all those original studies myself.
What I found interesting is not only did you talk about the value of adding fats back into your diet, but you really focused on harm that was done by advocating a low-fat diet. I mean, we've touched on this a little bit in terms of what we replace that fat with, but could you talk a little bit more about what's happened, your view about what's happened to our overall health by trying to follow a low-fat regime?
So there are basically two unintended consequences that came about by are deciding to cut back on fat. And we have successfully, over the past 30 years, reduced the amount of saturated fat we eat. Americans eat 11% less saturated fat than they did in the early 1970s. And we also eat, according to the dietary guidelines, 17% more fruits and vegetables. But when you take meat, butter, cheese, dairy off the plate, what replaces it is carbohydrates. So it's that big bottom slab of the USDA food pyramid, grains, pasta, rice. And Americans have, as a result, in the last 30 years, increased our carbohydrate intake by around 25%. The problem with having such a carbohydrate heavy diet is that carbohydrates, when they're digested in the bloodstream, they turn into glucose. Glucose spurs an insulin response in your blood, and insulin is like the king of all hormones for socking away fat. So the suggestion is that by shifting our diet to be a high carbohydrate diet, 60% of all calories is what we are recommended by the USDA, that that has led to the obesity and diabetes epidemics that we are suffering from today. So that's one of the big unintended consequences, I think, that was not foreseen when we were told to eliminate these central foods from our diet. And the other one we touched upon, which is the unintended consequence of shifting from saturated to unsaturated fats, which are vegetable oils, and the tremendous increase in our consumption of those vegetable oils from 1900 to today.
And in terms of vegetable oils, I mean, I know that you think butter, going back to butter, lard, and those types of more staple fats are better to cook with. But, you know, what about olive oil? What about, you know, oils that we very commonly cook with?
So olive oil occupies this unique position between vegetable oils and saturated fats. Olive oil only has, it's a technical thing, but it only has one double bond, which means it oxidizes less, it is less likely to oxidize than most vegetable oils, which have numerous double bonds in all their little fatty acid chains. So olive oil is kind of in between. I think olive oil is a terrific oil. What I write about in my book is that olive oil has not been shown to have any special magical heart disease fighting powers as we have thought, but it's a perfectly good, fine oil to use and is more stable than vegetable oils generally.
And this has led you to sort of question why we've elevated the Mediterranean diet so much, since it does encourage olive oil.
Right. Well, the Mediterranean diet is a great diet. The question that I ask in my book is just, is it the best possible diet? The reason I think that the U.S. came to embrace it is that it was the first diet that was introduced to Americans as a healthful diet in 1993 by Harvard nutrition epidemiologists. And it came in response to kind of the non-fat 1980s that Americans had been suffering through, with really trying to cook with almost no fat. That was like the height of our low-fat fascination. And the Mediterranean diet sort of arrived as a savior. All of a sudden, we could slather olive oil over everything and pour it over our salads and vegetables, and that was healthy. So it was like this savior diet. But it's also true that that diet came to be elevated in the eyes of nutritionists because the olive oil industry funded a series of the best ever food conferences all over the Mediterranean that were in these lush, beautiful spots. And so nutritionists studied the Mediterranean diet because it was a fantastic way to go to a scientific conference. But the point that I make in my book is that there are other high-fat traditional diets in countries with low rates of heart disease, as in the Mediterranean, that just were not studied because nobody wanted to go to Mongolia for a scientific conference. But they also have low rates of heart disease and a diet that may be equally healthy but just hasn't been studied.
So one of the things that you're recommending, of course, is to integrate more meat back into your diet if you've eliminated it out of fear of saturated fats. But what if you're a vegetarian and you want to, you know, you agree with your findings and you want to incorporate saturated fats back into your diet? What are your options?
I think it's perfectly, it's easy to be healthy without eating meat. I think there are sources of, I mean, animal foods have a number of vitamins in them, including vitamin B12 and B6, that are hard to get in a bioavailable form from plant foods. So, but there are other sources of them, eggs, cheese, milk. I mean, there are other sources of these important vitamins and the kinds of fat you need, saturated fat, for many functions in your body. So it's not necessary to eat meat. But I think it's harder to stay healthy without some animal foods in your body.
Diet. One of the things, though, that you do raise is that you think tropical oils have been wrongly maligned.
Oh, right. And that's another great source of saturated fat. So palm oil and coconut oil are high in saturated fat. They're stable. They're good to cook with. And so those are excellent sources of cooking fats, especially for vegetarians who don't want to eat animal foods. Those oils, we have believed since the late 1980s that they're bad for health. But that was another kind of remarkable, surprising story, because it was really the American Soybean Association that launched this, that saw tropical oils as a competitor to its own oil and launched this whole campaign to villainize tropical oils to try to get rid of the competition. And it was very successful. I mean, American food manufacturers used palm oil and coconut oil in their products. And by the end of this campaign in the late 1980s, that they had just zeroed out all of their usage of foreign tropical oils due to this, basically a trade campaign against them.
Now, some food industry, food makers are actually starting to sneak tropical oils back into their foods.
They are. I mean, there's palm oil that has made a comeback in the food industry. And the reason that is that it's very hard to make long-lasting, stable products that will last on supermarket shelves without some kind of solid fat. And so food manufacturers are actually kind of backed into a corner now, because they haven't been able to use tropical oils. There's a phobia about saturated fat generally. But they need that solid fat in order to make products that are long-lasting.
So you're saying that if you look at the label and you see that a palm oil or some kind of tropical oil has been used, like a coconut oil, that you should be less worried about that than if they're using a vegetable oil in one of their ingredients to help create sort of the texture and firmness that's can only be done by a hardened fat.
Yeah, I think that the reason that we have been afraid of saturated fat is that the original idea was that these fats caused heart disease. And there has been a reevaluation of the science, not only by me, but it's important to say there's two independent groups of scientists that have now gone back and looked at all the evidence on saturated fat, all those early studies. And those two groups, including scientists from Harvard and Berkeley, have also concluded that the evidence cannot be shown to say that saturated fats cause heart disease.
And we'll continue our conversation about whether fats, including saturated fats, belong in a healthy diet. Are you ready to embrace Nina Teicholz's recommendations of a high-fat diet? Have you already, and what have been the results? If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're discussing the merits of a high-fat diet with journalist Nina Teicholz, whose new book is The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. She'll be at the Commonwealth Club tomorrow at 6 p.m. Let's hear what our listeners have to say. Let's go to Hugh in Oakland. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. I have to address the last comment about palm oil spreads. They might be nutritionally sound, but the entire context is that it is not an environmentally friendly product. If you look at how palm trees are grown, They are leading to massive hardwoods being cut down in Indonesia and to the extinction of orangutans in Indonesia. That has to be mentioned.
Hugh, thanks so much. You know, Hugh's point actually brings up, as if we start advocating and people start adopting this idea that they should incorporate more saturated fats, there are environmental problems, not just with palm oil, but also with the production of beef. You know, beef requires tremendous amounts of resources, land and water. It also produces methane and emits that greenhouse gas. So I wonder if you could address Hugh's environmental concerns and others.
Yes. I think that there are big environmental questions about I'm aware of the deforestation issues with palm oil and also about methane gases with raising cattle. But the note what I think that those are huge questions that are they're just outside the scope of my book. And, you know, what I say in a note on meat and ethics at the end of my book is that it took me so many years just to get to the bottom of the question about nutrition. What is healthy? There's so much dispute about what is healthy amongst nutritionists now. And we need to try to resolve this for the American public to know, you know, what they can eat in order to not be obese and diabetic and suffer from heart disease. And that question was enough to fill 9 years and to fill a book. And we need to figure that out first, and then we can deal with whatever the environmental issues are. I think that we have not tried to ask these questions in the context of trying to eat more saturated fats.
Hugh, thanks for the call. A listener writes, the problem is we replace high-fat products, which are bad for you, with highly processed junk food that replaced most of the fat calories with sugar, which turned out to be even worse. That suggests we should all eat less junk food. It doesn't mean that butter is good for you. It's an interesting question because, you know, I think I want to be clear with you, Nina. You're not just saying that fat isn't as harmful as we originally thought, but you're also saying that integrating it is healthier than having a low-fat diet. You're actually saying that there are better health benefits to a high-fat diet than, say, the low-fat diet and even the Mediterranean diet.
So a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet has been found in numerous rigorous clinical trials over the past decade to be healthier than a low-fat diet. So that means And there are really only three macronutrients to eat. There's protein, carbohydrates, and fat. So if it's healthier to eat a high-fat diet, that means you're minimizing your carbohydrate intake. I think the point of this question that is written in is that, is it possible for us if we all just ate more unrefined carbohydrates, right? Let's all agree that sugar, refined carbohydrates are unhealthy. I think most nutritionists and experts will agree with that sugar is a culprit. If we're all to back off sugar, the question is, where then do we get our calories? It's possible to get a majority of your calories from complex carbohydrates, which are thought to be healthier. But there's enough clinical trial evidence to show that even a diet that is high in complex carbohydrates is less healthy than one that is low in carbohydrates and high in fat. So that suggests that really a diet that maximizes meat, cheese, butter, dairy, eggs is healthier than one that is high in grains and even whole grains and pasta and bread.
And let's go to more of your calls. Matthew in Davis. Hi, Matthew.
Hi. So I'm listening to this conversation with great interest, and I'm a researcher here at UC Davis, and I study the impact of nutrients on your genetics and personalized nutrition and personalized health and lifestyle. And I appreciate your guest's sort of analysis of the past and how we've gone wrong and making these broad-based recommendations about low-fat diets and whatnot. However, I'm having a hard time buying into this notion that we would all be better off by eating a diet with more fat. I think there's plenty of evidence that shows that people who maybe have had cardiovascular incidents or have clogged arteries do actually benefit from lower fat diets. And so the real culprit here is not necessarily fat or no fat, but the idea that we're making these broad recommendations to people. What we need to be doing, I believe, is making personalized recommendations for people based on your genetics, based on, so in the instance before of, well, a Mediterranean diet's been studied, but not a Mongolian diet. Well, maybe the Mongolian diet is right for Mongolians, and the Mediterranean diet is right for Mediterraneans.
Matthew, thank you.
I think that there's something there.
Thank you, Matthew. Nina Teicholz.
I think that is an excellent point, but I would say that all we have to rely upon to, and there is obviously an enormous amount of variation in the way that people respond to diet and exercise, but all we have to rely upon is science, which takes large groups of people. Hopefully you can even out some of the variation that we see amongst human beings in their responses and look at those people and put them on different diets. And I think that the best we can say about the last decade of clinical trials is that people who are on a higher fat diet in clinical trials, so, you know, this is what the science is telling us, the best that science can tell us now, in these trials, the people on a higher fat, low carbohydrate diet, restricting their carbohydrates, look better in terms of their outcome markers for obesity, their ability to lose weight, and for diabetes, and for their heart disease risk factors.
Matthew, thanks. Let's go to another call. Let's go to Peter in Davis as well. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Hi, Nina.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I work with a number of endurance athletes in the ultra-endurance markets, and I'm prescribing high-fat, carbohydrate-restricted diets, and we're getting performance that's kind of unbelievable. That I've had people set world records and American records and things like 100-mile running. People are winning races and things that traditionally people say is not possible using fat. And in fact, there's a study called FASTER that's just concluded the data collection, and it's actually going to rewrite the textbooks on what is thought possible in terms of athletic performance using fat. And so I want to commend Nina for coming out with this book and also support her that this is what our bodies are actually meant to do. And for most of the aerobic spectrum, and because the diet's been in so high in carbohydrates, it's prevented us from really tapping into fat. And what we try to do in our program is to get people back to burning fat as fuel.
So then, Peter, if I may ask you, is this a diet you'd recommend for everyday people, or is it really one that's better for athletes who would be burning,
well,
say, this kind of high-fat?
Well, here's the interesting thing. When regular people ask my athletes what they're doing, because they look great, they retain more lean body mass and all that, and they tell them they're on a high-fat, moderate protein, low-carbohydrate diet, people say, oh, you get away with all that fat because you run so much. And our response is, actually, no, we get away with the carbohydrates we eat because we run so much. Or we bicycle so much, because we do use some carbohydrates strategically. And if you think about it, the reason we carry a lot of fat and very limited glucose is glycogen, is because we're meant to burn fat as our aerobic energy source, and glycogen is a fight or flight fuel, except that because of the modern diet, it works against us, because as Nina pointed out, when you maintain higher insulin levels, your body is prevented from tapping into that energy source.
Well, Peter, thanks so much. And this is sort of the central premise or a key point in your book, which is that fat doesn't make us fat.
Right. That is that idea that fat makes you fat is based on the fact that fat per gram is denser in calories, about 9 calories per gram, compared to carbohydrate, which is 4 or 5 calories per gram. And so the idea was just that the greater number of calories in fat would make you fat. But the science really suggests now that our bodies do not process all calories from fat, protein, and carbohydrate in exactly the same way. I mean, just as I mentioned, you know, when you eat carbohydrate, it provokes an insulin response, which is different from what happens. That insulin response does not happen when you eat fat and protein. So the idea is that our body is not just a simple mathematical calculator of calories coming in and coming out, but there are more complex biological reactions to the different kinds of calories you're eating.
But still, some well-respected researchers and nutritionists also say that, you know, seeing that there's that fat doesn't make us fat, that there may be less harm than we previously thought, but that it shouldn't be interpreted as license to go out and eat a ton of steak and butter, in part because they feel like isolating just one nutrient isn't the best way to go, that we should always look at what we're eating in context. So if somebody wanted to adopt this, right, would it be safe for them to just start going out and changing their diet?
I, like many people, really advocate whole foods. And in this case, I think it's whole foods with whole fats in them. So animal foods like cheese and steak and eggs, they are really a perfect package of fat and protein in the right proportions. A certain amount of protein, it's about one third the protein to, you know, one part protein to two or three times the fat. And they're very dense in nutrients and minerals. So it's a perfect package of food. And I think that, you know, there are people out there eating sticks of butter who now think that as much saturated fat as possible is the right solution for them. I just think that we, you know, just eating whole foods in the way that our ancestors ate them is a better strategy.
And let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to Marco in Berkeley. Hi, Marco.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, please. What's on your mind?
Well, I just heard the documentary about how palm oil is bad for you and the rainforest. And I totally agree that it is bad for the rainforest. And me and my friends from school have made a sort of a magazine called The New Monkey Times. And we sell it. And all the money goes to orangutan shelters and animal shelters.
And Marco, how old are you?
I'm 10.
Well, Marco, and you wrote Monkey Times. Well, thanks so much for the comment. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And do you have a quick comment on that, Nina?
No, I think, you know, I have two boys, and I have to say that you know, it is a tremendous disconnect between what the kinds of things and the foods we eat at home and what they're learning at school. And it is often hard. They have defended bacon to their teachers. And so I understand this is especially confusing and conflicting information for children.
And let's go to more of your emails. Fernando writes, switching from being almost vegetarian to the paleo diet 3 months ago, that's a diet that's high in meats and vegetables, I believe, but not so much in dairy, is my understanding, which requires plenty of fat consumption, has made fabulous improvements in my life. It's eliminated back pain, improved sleep, improved skin, reduced sweet tooth, increased time in between meals without being hungry, and I've lost weight. Nothing in my short 40-plus year life has had such amazing effects. Neil writes, Nina, do you have any comments about eggs and cholesterol? That is, much like you've highlighted the press rush to a story torturing idle comments and complex analysis into misguided beliefs about saturated fats, my understanding is that the same happened for eggs, namely that when cholesterol was identified as a source of health problems, the press just sophomorically asked which foods have cholesterol in it, and then through mindless parroting made it a fact that eggs are bad for you, when in fact there's little evidence that this is the case. And Neil writes in parentheses, I have no vested interest in eggs. Any thoughts about it? You did touch upon how the media also contributed to this rush to embrace the low-fat diet as well.
Right. The media very early on adopted this theory, as everybody did, and they have they've been active actors in helping to elevate the hypothesis that saturated fats cause heart disease. I just want to respond to this question about cholesterol and the cholesterol in eggs. The original idea was that it was animal foods which contained saturated fats also contained cholesterol, and both of those were what raised your blood cholesterol. It was understood and found pretty early on in the 1970s that the cholesterol you eat is only very weakly connected to the cholesterol in your blood. That correlation was not very strong. There were some people who were particularly sort of so-called high responders, but most people can regulate the amount of cholesterol in their blood regardless of whether they're eating one egg or 50 eggs. So, and almost all Western nations have backed off restrictions on dietary cholesterol, and the American Heart Association's most recent guidelines last December finally dropped their dietary cholesterol restriction. So with a kind of tacit understanding that the evidence really has never been there.
In a complement to that question on alcohol, Karen writes, so if saturated fats aren't responsible for high bad cholesterol, what is?
So again, our understanding of cholesterol has evolved enormously, or blood lipids, I should say, has evolved enormously over the last 50 years, trying to predict what causes or what can be used as a marker for a heart attack is a difficult and evolving science. And there are markers for inflammation. There are, you know, there are more predictive biomarkers now, something called LDL particle number. Again, your LDL subfractions. All of those do look worse on a high carbohydrate diet. So that suggests that carbohydrates play a role in worsening those biomarkers.
Jim writes, please ask the author to state her biases, funding by outside organizations, belief systems, influences. Have you been funded by?
I've received no money from industry of any kind in writing this book or before in any way. And as I said, you know, my bias was against a high fat or meat diet because I was a vegetarian when I started off this whole endeavor. So if anything, my bias was against it.
Jane writes, luckily, I never gave up any of those items. I'm assuming she's referring to meat and other high-fat foods. And neither do I eat solidified hydrogenated oils. Always eat eggs, meat, cheese, and olive oil, of course. But I gave up wheat and regular milk due to gluten intolerance. Never gained weight. I'm a healthy 70-plus. And Elizabeth writes, I lost my faith in dietary buzzwords the day I saw a bag of gumdrops labeled fat-free. Paul writes, I'm concerned that those proposing a diet with significant amounts of meat and dairy are ignoring all the recent science. Current research suggests that meat and oil consumption work through our gut biome to produce vascular inflammation, which is the basis of cardiovascular disease. Although the diet industry has encouraged people to overconsume carbohydrates as part of a low-fat diet, this does not justify a return to the so-called paleo diet. The American Heart Association and most people working to reduce cardiovascular disease strongly advise reducing meat and fat consumption. People should watch the Forks Over Knives movie if they are on the fence. Of course, there is also the fact that a meat-based lifestyle is really incompatible with an ever-growing 9 billion-person planet. We have to begin making a change. Do you want to talk a little bit about the American Heart Association, which continues to recommend a very small proportion of fat in the diet, as if I'm recalling that correctly?
The American Heart Association has actually evolved on their position of total fat. So it used to be that they recommended, one of their top bullet points was that we should reduce our fat overall to between 25 to 35% of calories. That, as a top recommendation, that is now gone. And that is really a response to the largest ever trial of the low-fat diet, which was the Women's Health Initiative on nearly 50,000 women. And the low-fat diet is the most studied diet in the history of nutrition science. And that study showed that that diet did women after being on that diet for 7 years lost on average 1 pound more than people on their regular diet. So it didn't help with weight loss. It didn't help with reducing any of the risk of heart disease. And there was only a slight reduce in the risk for ovarian cancer, but otherwise there was an increase in other kinds of cancer risks. So that diet is a failed diet, and the American Heart Association and the USDA have both they've both backed off their total fat restriction. They are still very much on board with reducing saturated fat. And the American Heart Association actually is ratcheting back their restrictions on saturated fats to 5 or 6% of calories for people at risk of heart disease, and which are, you know, levels unseen really in human history outside of periods of famine and post-war devastation. So, you know, the American Heart Association has been in this from the beginning. They're the original authors of this recommendation, and it's not surprising that they are really that they're sticking with it.
Will writes, people in Japan are among those in the world who live the longest, and the Japanese diet is very low in fat. Would your guest please address this?
The Japanese in post-World War II were measured as having a low-fat diet and having long life expectancy, and they have been selected, I would say, sort of cherry-picked by the proponents of the low-fat diet hypothesis. It is also true in that same period that there were dairy farmers in Ireland who lived on nothing but dairy products and lard who lived equally long. But the history of our understanding of nutrition has really, the expert understanding has been one of selecting certain data points that support their hypothesis and ignoring others.
And let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to Arthur in San Francisco. Hi, Arthur.
Hi, how's it going?
Well, thanks. Go ahead, please.
Yes, so I've been diagnosed pre-diabetic about 2 years ago when my wife gave birth to my son, and I had to get shots. I had no idea it was a hereditary pre-diabetes. And as I started researching the sugar content in a lot of different foods, at first, I was grabbing onto low-fat foods and low-fat, but I've realized actually that low-fat foods contain incredible amount of sugar comparatively to, foods with fat content, larger fat content. And I was listening to actually a show a few months ago about how American manufacturers started adding more sugar into low-fat content, such as low-fat yogurts and low-fat cottage cheese and such and such, to basically substitute the lack of fat that is missing. So that way the low-fat food can actually taste better. And I believe they probably did that for different reasons, such as saving perhaps costs on amount of fat that was added to this, to such food. So I find that when I eat actually low-fat food, my glucose spikes up because as I'm actually looking at the ingredients on such low-fat yogurts and such products, it shows that there is actually more sugar in those products.
Arthur, thanks. I see Nina Teicholz nodding, and I just wanted I think there's something she'd like to definitely say to your comment.
I mean, your comment is absolutely correct, which is that when you take fat out of food, low-fat peanut butter, low-fat yogurt, the fat provides texture and flavor. And to replace that, companies use what's called fat replacers. They're almost always carbohydrate-based, and they're often only just sugar. So low-fat foods are almost always higher in carbohydrates, including sugar. Your typical low-fat yogurt has about a Hershey's bar worth of sugar in it.
Arthur, thanks so much. Richard writes, as a fan of high-fat diets, my wife and I have lost 85 pounds between us on a low-carb and high-fat diet. I've been disappointed in the menu options for seniors and the ill who are in the care of skilled nursing facilities and hospitals. I'm a caregiver for a 91-year-old relative who has diabetes and congestive heart failure. The diets available to her at these institutions are all top-heavy in carbohydrates. We finally took control of her diet by moving her into our home and fed her a low-carb, high-fat diet. The report from the last X-ray reported that the issues of her congestive heart failure were resolved, and her diabetes is controlled with just 5 units of Lantus at nighttime. We found that we had to increase the amounts of fat she ate and reduce proteins because the high amounts of protein were apparently affecting her kidneys. One thing that Richard's comment makes me think about is also just if somebody wanted to embrace more of a high-fat diet, the availability of high-fat foods and even institutions in terms of providing them are still a bit behind.
Well, we have been living for almost 60 years now with the idea that high-fat foods are bad for health. So this is something that you see in institutions. Hospitals, have typically terrible diets that are high in carbohydrates. I mean, one of the things that's true is that carbohydrates are the cheapest kind of food. That is one of the reasons why you see the obesity epidemic most prevalent amongst poor populations now. Those are the cheapest calories. Pasta's cheap. Bread is cheap. Those are the cheapest calories that are available. And those are also cheap foods for institutions.
And let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to Pepper in Berkeley. Hi, Pepper.
Hi. I just wanted to thank the Eco Hero 10-year-old for his monkey newsletter. That's wonderful. And I want to thank the author for spreading the word that there's nothing wrong with high fat in diet. But as individuals, the single greatest thing that we can do to preserve the environment is to base our diets on primary source foods, on whole foods, and that can all be plant-based. And we can learn to make sure that we get B12 and omega-3 fatty acids, and it can all come from plant-based foods and contribute what our responsibility is for the environment as well.
Pepper, thanks. You'd find agreement here that from Nina, I'm sure that we do need to consider the environmental impacts of eating animal products. Let's go to one more call here. Let's go to Mark in Greenbrae. Hi, Mark. Hi, Mark. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's go to Anna in San Jose. Hi, Anna.
Hi. I just wanted to say that, your guest is talking about how our ancestors ate dairy products. And really, our ancestors did not eat dairy products until animals were actually domesticated. And the dairy products that we eat nowadays are, the cows have to be constantly kept pregnant in order to produce enough milk. And so it's a very unnatural situation. They've also been genetically engineered in order to provide enough milk to be able to make a profit, for these industries to profit. And so our ancestors really were not eating dairy products.
Anna, thanks. I just want to give Nina a chance to respond since we're short on time.
Yes, when I say ancestors, I don't mean our Paleolithic ancestors, which you're right, were not eating dairy products, but it was after the domestication of animals that we were able to eat those. And I would also agree that the quality of the animal products that we have now, you know, because of hormones and antibiotics and you know, the way that we mass produce them, creates problems with their quality. Another reason for us to investigate how best to produce ecologically sustainable, healthy animal foods.
And Nina, we just have a little bit of time left. You know, I think one of the things, though, is that your dietary advice, I know you're not a nutritionist, but your book does provide some dietary advice, is part of so many different kinds of conflicting dietary advice. What's a final thought you have to say to folks who are just trying to wade their way through all these different recommendations?
You know, I just have to go back to the scientific studies that the last decade of clinical trials with many kinds of people, different kinds of populations, and a sizable number of people, enough to say that a high fat, a diet that is high in fat, I'm saying, you know, 50% fat and 20% protein and restricted in carbohydrates, really has the best outcomes for obesity and diabetes and heart disease.
Nina Teicholz, thank you.
Thank you.
We were joined this hour by investigative journalist Nina Teicholz, whose new book is The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. She'll be at the Commonwealth Club tomorrow at 6. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Jim Bennett. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.